Welcome back to the MJA podcast. I'm Kate Swanell and I'm the journal's news and online editor. Today my guest and I are talking about a problem plaguing many a medical researcher, navigating the red tape of ethics and governance approvals. Dr. Christopher Freeman is a pharmacist and a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Queensland. He and his colleagues involved in the Remain Home trial have penned an article for the MJA detailing their epic odyssey through approval land and offering up some solutions. Chris is my guest on the pod today. Before we get into the details of the ethics approval process, tell us a little bit about the trial you were running, Remain Home. Tell us a little bit about what that was about.
Yeah, so Remain Home is a project that looks at integrating pharmacists into general practice medical centres. So these pharmacists are what we've termed non-dispensing pharmacists. And the objective there was to, for patients who see GPs at those recruited medical centres, for once they are discharged from hospital, to come out and see the pharmacist inside the general practice and then also see the GP. And the intent there was to reconcile any medicine changes that may have occurred during their stay in hospital to make sure that the patient then fully understood what had happened to their medicines while they were being treated, and then to flag any issues, whether that might be enacting the discharge plan as prescribed by the hospital team, or they might have flagged within the interim period between discharge and coming home a new problem that has arisen.
Okay.
And to try and manage that. And really the plan there is to stop people unnecessarily representing into hospital. Our outcomes really look at readmission rates over multiple time points.
Okay, so how wide a net were you throwing in terms of recruiting participants?
So we initially attempted to see the project operate over two states, Victoria and Queensland, but the way that the project ended up being funded meant that it was only able to run in Queensland. So the practices, we had 14, and they were located in and around the southeast corner of Queensland.
You've ended up writing a research letter about the problems you encountered getting ethics approvals, basically.
Yes, and governance,
And governance approvals. So tell me where you struck trouble or where you struck red tape, shall we say. Where did the problem start happening?
So we reflected once the project had started in terms of the intervention about the frustrations that we had with both the ethics and the governance approval processes. And I should comment to say that we do strongly believe that ethics and governance review is, you know, absolutely vital to responsible research. This is not to suggest that this isn't, but it's the process which is undertaken that causes difficulty. So we thought, instead of internally complaining to one another about it, that we should actually publish our experience to share that with people, but also to come up with some potential solutions so that a conversation can be started about how the process might be changed. And, you know, we've had several conversations with other research groups and they've all expressed, you know, similar types of concerns. And for us, this really was dominant in research that required either multi-site approval or research which transitioned sectors of care. So, for example, from hospital into primary care, where notoriously those sectors don't speak well to one another. And for us, that persisted into the governance and ethics side of things. So we thought, as I said, rather than complaining internally about it, that we should actually start a national conversation around what might be done to help improve things.
Give us an example of the tangled web that occurred.
I think so there are two parts that we saw problems in, and one was the ethics application. Because it was intersectorial research for patients transitioning care, we actually had to apply for a number of ethical approvals. And I think, you know, reflecting on our previous research to what we did with the Remain Home, the ethics application process had been improved through the national ethics application process. And so we applied through one of the hospital sites for the multi-centre ethics review. But we also had private hospitals participating in our research, which don't subscribe to, well, the ones certainly we involved didn't subscribe to the multi-centre review. One of them accepted a low-risk application based on the multi-centre approval, but the second private hospital site wanted a full application using completely different forms to what the NEEF looked like. So we ended up having to write three separate ethics applications for the same project. And frustratingly, despite having approval through the single public hospital site for the multi-centre, some of the private hospitals wanted additional changes to occur based on some of the materials we provided or the way that we were running the trial, which required us to then seek amendments to the original ethics applications that we had first received. So that's frustrating that one committee would see that the application is sound from their perspective, yet another has a different view, and that they don't communicate with one another. And so we found that the time range between for each of those groups to do their own ethics approval process ranged remarkably. So one of them took only 40 days to actually review it and get it back to us, where another took over 100 days. You know, you just can't deal with, you know, in a defined project space where you've got time pressure to actually start and complete your project, spending significant amount of times without actually even putting a foot on the ground in terms of getting the project up and running.
How much time did it cost you on the Remain Home trial?
Well, it took us, we calculated, around 230 days from start to actually getting the final ethics and governance approval through. And so our project is a three-year project funded for that time. And the funding was through the HCF Research Foundation, but then also supported by the two PHNs that the intervention was taking place in. And they were quite, particularly the PHNs, were quite strict on having the project finish at a certain time due to the funding arrangements that we had negotiated with them. And so that basically meant that a quarter of our project time had basically vanished before we could even start the intervention. The problem with our particular project is that it requires a 12-month follow-up period following the intervention. So even just with follow-up, we've got 12 months out of that 3 years where we're unable to sort of move that, which required us to basically truncate the intervention to a shorter period than what we were hoping.
So it has actually potentially affected the quality of the data you might get?
I certainly think so. And we're still collecting the data now because we're in that 12-month follow-up phase. But, you know, certainly it did two things for us. I think the shorter time period reduced the number of patients that we could recruit. And it's clear that we haven't met our pre-specified sample size because of that. It's also meant that the timing of when the intervention occurred, we had planned to finish well before the Christmas sort of period. And given the delays, we meant that the intervention had to cross through that sort of December, January period where staff changes and holidays and those sorts of things were occurring. And so that sort of interrupted the intervention partly because of that as well. So I think it certainly affected our ability to recruit our pre-specified sample size, but also in terms of the practicalities of actually running the intervention for a health services research project where you're relying on staff who are practicing within those areas to be able to be available. And, you know, we had initially pitched to those people who were participating that this would finish well before the Christmas break, and they were very happy to put off, you know, holidays and leave until then. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden we said that actually we're going to have to go through the Christmas break now, and that caused some issues, and we had to recruit additional staff to replace people who were going on leave and those sorts of things.
I'm chatting today with Dr. Christopher Freeman, and we're talking red tape and paperwork. Chris's co-authored research letter on the subject is available open access at nja.com.au. Chris, is there a predictability about this in the sense, can you see a pattern about where you think the snarl-ups are going to come? Is it a particular sector? Is it private healthcare providers? Is it hospitals? Are you able to see where the trouble might be coming from?
Yeah, so I think we had a fair idea given the type of research we were doing, even though it was what we considered to be low risk. We had sort of planned to have time in the project to receive the ethics applications.
Yeah.
I think where we stumbled into a bit of trouble, which we weren't prepared for was the process for the site-specific approvals or the governance approvals at each of the hospital sites. So, you know, we had 11 hospital sites participating with us in which we're recruiting patients from. Nine of those required governance approvals. The two private hospitals didn't require governance approvals. They were happy to proceed with just the ethics approval. But they were spread across two local health networks, the sort of broader catchment of where the hospitals sit.
Okay.
And frustrating for us was that hospitals, even within the same local health network, took different processes in which they wanted the governance approval to go through. The timelines, even within those local health networks, were completely different. The range in time was really significant. And and in some local health networks, some of the hospitals decided not to go with what their area's process was and to create their own. And so a good example of some of the interesting things we were asked to do was that we had to submit a nominal budget, even though that this project was not going to cost the hospital a cent, even in staff time or in-kind funding. We actually had to still stipulate a budget because they wouldn't approve it without a budget. So we had to make some nominal fee up to be able to actually get it through the governance process. So, you know, it's just this almost the ivory tower equivalent of red tape where people who aren't involved in undertaking research projects are probably ticking boxes to see if they've got things in line to approve the application but haven't actually thought through the process properly.
Clearly the national ethics approval form has helped, but it's not the whole solution, is it?
No, and that's exactly right. I think with credit where credit's due, I think the process has improved from our perspective, but not all interested parties or environments will take the NEEF form. So, for example, the public hospitals. And I think what we haven't thought hard enough about in this current system, particularly in intersectorial research, is the governance component that goes along with that. And most governance approvals won't let you actually start that application until that you've received ethics approval. So you can't even concurrently work on the two processes at the same time. You've got to wait for your ethics approval to be put through before you even start governance.
So what's the next step? What's your recommendation about what needs to happen to make this better?
Well, this was the interesting thing, Kate. We sat as a group and said, okay, we've identified clearly what we think the problems are, but what is the solution that we can come up with? And it was interesting earlier this year, there was also a paper talking about governance approvals published in the MJA.
Yes, it was.
It was interesting that our recommendations lined very closely with theirs. And so what we suggested is that for governance approvals, that they happen at the area of the local health network rather than the individual hospital sites.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, for example, a local hospital network might contain five hospitals, and there would be a process of submitting your governance application to that LHN, and they would provisionally approve that and then seek counter signatures from the hospital sites. If the hospital sites disapproved that, they would have to clearly identify very specific reasons about why they wouldn't approve it that at their own site. And so we think that this would speed up the process. So there is a standardised form, it goes to a nominated person, and that person within the LHN is charged with actually progressing that forward. So I think importantly to that, I think what we found was there wasn't very clear guidance in some of those sites about how to actually progress your governance application. And so we've suggested also that via the website of that local health network, that there is a clear process with the documentation attached to that, but also updated anticipated turnaround times, so that when you're planning your research, you can actually see that it might take you 2 to 3 months before you actually get your ethics and governance approvals through, before you can start actually your intervention for your project. And then when you need to apply for extensions for your project because you're running behind because of these processes, you've got some objective evidence to submit with that application to yes. say, well, you know, these are the timelines that have been published and we're at the mercy of those.
So it would be great if the LHNs had a person whose job it was to facilitate ethics and governance approvals for researchers. Let you guys get on with the study design and let that particular person take care of the paperwork, because that's what it is, isn't it? It's paperwork.
It is all paperwork. You're exactly right. And
yeah.
I think partly the problem, it requires multiple signatures from multiple departments within the site, and so from finance and from governance review and multiple others. And getting those signatures can be arduous. And at the moment, the researchers are having to often facilitate that themselves rather than going through someone who might have those connections already established. I think the other thing to acknowledge is the costs that comes with that. You know, we as part of the project, employed research staff to obviously help us run the project. And so a lot of their time initially was spent sending emails or telephone calls or attending meetings or to try to get these approvals through. And I'm not saying that's often just a bad thing, but sometimes when they become overly arduous, this takes away from what they would otherwise be doing.
Yes.
And you know, costs a significant amount of money. We had to put off our research assistants by a number of months because they couldn't start the patient recruitment component until we received their approval. So we had them ready to start, and then we had to say, sorry, would you mind waiting for a couple of months while we sort this out? The paper that was published earlier in the mm-hmm. MJA this year quoted a figure over $250,000 spent in dealing with their ethics and governance approvals processes. And, you know, that to me, as I said at the beginning, is important to have these processes in place. But mm-hmm. when they're costing that sum of money, you've got to consider whether if that's the best use of the resource allocation that we've got, which is really limited.
What are the barriers to getting this done?
Well, I think we need to have a conversation first as a research community to articulate what the actual problems are and to come up with what we believe the solutions are. And you know, we've hopefully helped started that conversation. I think that the next part is to actually get the people who can make these decisions in a room together and include the researchers as a key stakeholder in that that the process can be designed around the needs of the researchers and then also considering the needs of the ethics and governance committees. Because one without the other is going to create a situation where there are obviously unintended consequences. The ability for researchers to be, particularly early and mid-career researchers, to obtain research funding is getting harder and harder. And if you're having to invest significant amount of money into actually undertaking this process without actually doing any of the research, or it's actually at the cost of getting the project to run and how it's supposed to run, for example, with recruitment, then, you know, it's potentially wasted funds there. And so, you know, when you've got limited resources, you've got to make the most out of them in terms of to getting the best return on investment. The people who receive the benefit of the evidence that's then generated would also, and a lot of this is public funds at the end of the day. As people experience these arduous processes in terms of gaining these approvals, what it might start to do is reduce researchers' appetite to actually undertake research where they have to include multiple sites across multiple states or include research where there is a transition in care.
Yeah.
And everyone knows the data and how long transition care has been a problem in this country. And if we continue to create barriers from a research perspective, then people are potentially going to be less likely to want to actually participate in undertaking research in these areas, and it's vital. So, you know, the unintended consequences of this is that it may actually reduce the research production in this sort of area as well.
Thanks, Chris, for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you, Kate, for the opportunity. I appreciate it too.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.